And I can cut it. I can cut it out.
So, hello and welcome. You've come to the Fat-Tailed Thoughts after show, where Jared and I sound a little bit less professional and goof around like the normal humans we normally are. Hey, Jared, we've just talked about embedded finance.
I have never been called professional before, so I like this.
Well, you sound so bloody professional on these podcasts and knowledgeable. But so, listeners, this is new. Jared and I goof around all the time. Jared is really good fun to hang out with, but I get him for the most serious half an hour of our week, and I thought
it's the only serious half an hour of the week.
Yeah, so I thought we'd just go and goof around as an after show and give you some extra content. So
yeah, this one's wild. This space is absolutely wild, because it's when I think about where it's going, I mean, Alex Rampell over it at Andreessen Horowitz, who's a general partner over there. Now, it's helpful. So he is actually the one who called out September of last year, started talking through that, like, hey, we've got this new payment network. We've got this new payment rail. We've got this ability to understand SKU level data. And he wrote a wonderful Twitter thread about the whole thing. It's really helpful to understand his viewpoint and his history. He was CEO or president of a major payments platform that go back about a decade got acquired by Visa.
So he knows the money flow. He knows the network.
Steven, this one gets crazier. So that product is now part of it. Got rolled up into Visa's fintech arm and so on and so forth. The rest of the team that was part of that acquisition, Alex leaves and goes and joins Andreessen Horowitz. He's now doing a lot of really cool work over there. The team that got left at Visa and stayed with the acquisition, that now forms the leadership team for Visa's crypto efforts. So this goes really, really, really deep. I mean, these are folks that intimately understand what happened.
This is what people aren't seeing, I don't think. You know, the Visa MasterCard duopoly that we've had for decades is at risk. You look at the breadcrumbs and follow them around the industry. You know, MasterCard buying CipherTrace to get into tracking and sort of fraud management. You look at what Block are doing with buying Afterpay, and obviously the stuff they're doing with crypto. I mean, you join all these dots up, and consumers aren't realizing that the level of disruption and innovation that's going on in this space.
Oh, it's wild. I mean, let's be very, very clear. We I think there's a lot of people talking about network effects as social networks were getting built and so on. And take a look at net margins. Take a look at return on equity. The best network effect businesses we've ever built are the card networks. I mean, they are wild. Visa's posting, like, I forget what it was, a 45% return on equity. MasterCard's 120%. I mean, these are numbers that businesses simply don't do. Visa's operating, it's a $500 billion company. MasterCard's another 350. Amex is however big it is. I mean, these are wildly profitable businesses that just print money. They've been unchallenged for 40 years, for 50 years. And for the first time, look, I don't think they go away overnight. I think most of them will probably evolve and offer new services and all that kind of fun stuff. But for the first time, we're seeing meaningful challenges, and not from like a merchant saying, hey, I don't like paying the fees. We're seeing challenges from consumers saying, ooh, I like that thing. Yeah, that's pretty. That's cool. I like paying that way. It's better.
Can I have some of that, please? Oh, and I like this crypto thing. And if you can add that to that and put a bit of this in it. Oh, I like all those three things put together. I mean, this level of disruption. I mean, I don't think companies as big as Visa and MasterCard go away, but they have really, really got to get smart quick, because they are
building the teams. They got the right people. I don't envy that challenge.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the classic Kodak and digital moment. They've got the innovator's dilemma of, I've got to disrupt the thing that's built the business I've got, but something disruptive.
Yeah, maybe we should pick Netflix with streaming, because Kodak didn't do quite so hot on that one.
I think we're at the point of where the digital camera gets launched and how does Kodak respond. You know, will Visa, MasterCard, Diners, and Amex all make it across to the other side?
I like that you still call it Diners, by the way.
Sorry. Yes, I'm the wrong age, people. I'm a diner's card person.
Are you going to bring traveler's checks with you to the UK?
No.
Okay.
How much the pound to dollar conversion rate has changed since the last time. Wow.
Yeah, that's a wild ride.
Yeah, I came over here 8 years when it was 1.5. Last time I checked, it was 1.2.
That's wild.
Yeah, that's crazy, right?
But if I look at the people, we touched on PayPal, we touched on Square. They are what they're both creating in slightly different spaces. They got there differently. Square starting as a hardware company and growing up. PayPal starting as a payments company, gets acquired by eBay, does online payments and is now kind of growing. Got currency conversion. They've got cryptocurrency buying and selling. They went the Square route. You can now get a credit card swiper reader, whatever it is, built into PayPal. They're both building almost kind of the shopping mall of payments and finance and so on. You could realistically today with Square or with PayPal run an entire merchant business online or in person and basically never touch a bank. That is a wild, wild idea.
That's crazy.
We
talk about regulation not keeping up. I mean, Block or Square, whatever you want to call them, are they being as regulated as they need to be? I mean, I don't know. I think Dorsey has seen something here, seen the sort of tea leaves in whatever funky tea he's drinking, and is navigating a path through. We talked about it on the pod a few minutes ago using the Lightning Network. He's going to be the disruptor in this space, I think.
You think he's got some tricks hidden up his beard?
I think so.
Sorry.
I mean, just the people he rolls with, the Jack Maulers, the Elons, those guys aren't looking at the traditional kind of stack and going, oh, yeah, we want to play within that playground. They're looking and going, yeah, we want to disrupt.
I'm going to talk out both sides of my mouth. I'm happy that the regulators have taken a relatively light touch mm-hmm. regulatory approach to PayPal, to Square. Certainly, we haven't seen any big blow ups in that space at scale. We've had some slip ups along the way. Not with them, with other firms that no longer exist. One, in the wake of 2008-2009, we had a payment processing business that had been bailed out by Goldman Sachs and others to the tune of $1 billion, $1.5 billion. I think that memory serves, that was the biggest blow up we've had. But yes, there's a huge aspect of their business that it's built on regulatory arbitrage, meaning they understood early on that Dodd-Frank, like what Jamie Dimon came out and said as it was being written, it's going to be a massive cost burden. A big bank is able to shoulder that. Compliance is inherently scalable. A small bank simply can't. And of course, we've seen since 2008, we've seen the number of banks in the U.S. get cut in half.
Yeah.
That's consolidation still alone. Playing out.
Yeah. Consolidation alone.
So my expectation, yes, it's at some point, even though they are good actors, at some point the regulators are going to go, look, we're just not comfortable with the scale of the consumer interactions that's now existing outside the banking regulatory perimeter. And whether it's because they update the banking regulations or to pull them in, or it's because they write a new set of regulations that say, look, we get that you're not exactly the same, but at the same time, we want to have a better sense of what it is you're doing. It has to happen.
Yeah.
By the way, that may not be from like, you can't do this anymore, you need more risk capital. Just starting with, in Dodd-Frank, we've embedded in there a regulator, the Fed, that's required to look out for systemic risk at the country level.
And we're now at scale that makes sense, right?
They're just not getting the data from those firms to understand consumer debt exposures. I mean, we see credit card debt ticking up and up and up. We don't really have a good finger on the pulse of the consumer debt that's being extended via these other firms that sit outside the regulatory perimeter. And if your job is to look out for systemic risk, Yeah, at some point you're going to say, let me figure out how I get those feeds back in.
Well, you said on the pod, 91% of consumer loans in California. That's a pretty
Wild. That's all that number's going to tick up. I mean, look, the underwriting models are good, but not great right now. Yes. It's still a growing industry. They're taking, I think a firm was taking like 1% write-offs. That we're going to find out if assuming the country goes into a recession or whatnot, I would expect those numbers do tick up. They've got the advantage of having relatively short duration, but it's going to take them some time to get those underwriting models better. So as they better understand when and who and where and what types of products, that model is going to get copy and pasted into places where bigger and bigger transaction sizes and goes, look, here, you're buying a car. You might not need an auto loan, but why not just pay in four as opposed to paying all up front? Like right now, your choice is really, I'm going to take an auto loan. Maybe I don't like taking out a loan, a hard credit check, etc. But I really don't want to extend that cash right now because it means I got to go sell something on my stock portfolio or whatever. Yeah, sure, I'll take a pay in four so I can do that over time. That's not really viable right now because the underwriting models aren't there. They're not good enough. The underwriter is not comfortable with taking on that type of credit risk. But get enough data points, write enough stuff at $1,000, $5,000, $10,000 click, and all of a sudden you go, yeah, you know what? I'm okay with the underwriting profile of that pay in four, and I don't need to do a hard credit check to make it happen.
Well, and we just then moved a $50,000 loan out of a bank, into a relatively lightly regulated entity.
What's the systemic risk then if that
loan defaults and somebody at scale, you know, what happens? And I mean, this is where the regulators have got to start looking at this stuff.
So they do have a better finger on it than I think would come after it at first blush. So the buy now, pay later firms, for the most part, want to be technology firms. They don't want to be financing firms. They don't want to be banks. So what they do is they will set up, there are a couple different ways to do it. You can do a warehousing agreement. There's a couple other ways you can do it. Ignore the details. What they do is they partner with a capital provider under the covers. Oftentimes that's a bank. Depending on how you structure it, there are two different things you're solving for. One is I just need cash. Like I need cash to fund this loan to pay the merchant before I get paid back. And the second part of this is the risk profile. If that person fails, if the consumer fails to pay me back, who takes the losses? Is it the capital provider? Is it the buy now, pay later firm? You can actually split those out. So in a model where you're just being the capital provider, that actually, those can be super high interest, very attractive, low risk loans that can fit a banking model really nicely. If you want to offload the risk alongside the capital, you start moving outside the banking sector. You start looking at, say, hedge funds and debt funds who go, look, I'm willing to get paid more and take on that risk. I'm okay taking on my balance sheet. That is inherently, again, we talked about with embedded finance, the partnership between technology and financing. That's a really good model there across the whole spectrum. I think where the regulators are going to get uncomfortable with that model is when that risk is getting split out and it's sitting with the buy now, pay later firm, or the risk is getting split out and as a result, the capital is coming from hedge funds or debt funds. Now the regulators are going to go, look, I know there's money moving. I know it results in consumers taking on debt, and I have no visibility to what the hell's going on.
Yeah, this is 2008 sort of all over again. I know there's money flowing around the system somewhere. I've got very limited oversight of it. Different scenario.
Yeah,
what happens if it starts to unwind at the back end and we get a lot of defaults? How does that flow back up through the system? And who's left carrying the can, basically?
Correct. I mean, take this all the way to kind of the absurd conclusion here. If you take the mortgage underwriting in 2008, going into the financial crisis, you had banks and you had non-banks underwriting mortgages that they would take just the servicing fee, just the underwriting fee, and just wholly offload that mortgage to somebody else. which means that they only really held on to the risk for the, between the time that somebody initiated it and the time they could sell it. And they kept getting that shorter and shorter and shorter. So they didn't give two shits about what the quality of that mortgage was, because I'm just getting paid a transaction fee, and if they fail to pay that mortgage, someone else takes the losses. Now, over time, they could offload all of those and then kept holding on to a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more of, the, of that residual risk. What we're, take the buy now, pay later financing model all the way to the extreme. They are just creating a loan. They have detailed consumer data, but then they offload the, they could offload the full risk of default to some third party. That is not, that that is good for a technology firm, not necessarily good from a systemic.
We've done this past before, and we know how the, how it could end. So I mean, really interesting discussion. Great for us to be sort of goofing around and talking about this on the after show here. I mean, what are you seeing? What should people be reading? Where should people be going looking? You never give your sources on the show. Maybe in the after show we give some of the.
No, I'm happy to. So the place I'd start, because you can pull on the thread here. This happened just yesterday or the day before, I think. Patrick O'Shaughnessy joined Colossus. So Patrick O'Shaughnessy, if you know the podcast Invest Like the Best, there's a sister podcast over there at Colossus, joincolossus.com, if you haven't seen it, called Business Breakdowns. And they just did a wonderful episode on Afterpay. The reason I'm suggesting going on the website, go listen to the episode. You'll get a really nice insight into how Afterpay works and the economics and all that kind of fun stuff. But on the website, if you pull up that episode, there's a section called Blocks. They have a list of 10 or 15 resources that digs into Affirm. It digs into how the economics work. It digs into how Klarna works. It's got Alex's Twitter thread. They rolled up a whole bunch of really, really helpful resources from across the industry. And you can basically go as deep as you want. You can keep any one of those will kick you out to three or four.
You can keep pulling on the thread and you're going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, it's the type of stuff where I go read something and then 20 minutes later I've got 45 tabs open and my computer crashes.
Yeah, I'm glad it's not just me. When I'm writing these research notes, I'm like, okay, just stop now. Where am I? What's going on my screen?
I guess the only thing I wish is I wish I had found that before I started writing the letter. It would have saved me. I ended up having a huge amount of overlap there. It would have saved me a lot of work.
Well, it was a good letter, a good show. I mean, we want to record these after shows just a little bit to give you a peek behind the scenes. What are we doing next week? What's up on your... I don't want to hold your feet to the fire and get you to commit, but what are we thinking? Are you again down on an embedded finance? Is that where we're going again next week?
I may double-click on that one again. There's a couple other places I may go poke around. There's a lot of stuff happening on the regulatory front. A lot of stuff happening at the Fed right now. Clearly, the tech markets have kind of blown up. Valuations have fallen off a cliff. I may go look at that. There's been some really good writing by Thomas Tungas on the changing valuations on, I'm embarrassingly blanking on his name, but major VC here in New York at Union. Who's written on the changing valuations and the financing, what it means to build during hard times and plan for those. That is a particularly interesting conversation. I mean, we had about 10 minutes of a hard financing environment for startups at the start of the pandemic, but that didn't last. That turned out for many to be a massive tailwind. Where many startups are kind of staring down the barrel of what may end up being the hardest financing environment since 2008 and before that, after the NASDAQ crashed, that's going to shake out a lot of startups who basically built on cheap money.
Compressed multiples. I mean, I wrote about a company raising $110 million into a $1.1 billion valuation. Probably one of the last, I think, that's going to be able to sort of cross into that. We'll obviously see them raise, but those raises, I mean, I hope they're super prudent with that money compress their burn rates and
survive. It raises a lot of hard challenges. For a company like that who's raised a lot at a high valuation at a high multiple, that can raise challenges for future rounds.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to raise a down round, meaning at a lower valuation, because it screws over employees and existing investors, but you may have to. Trying to grow into that valuation can be tougher. For firms that are, hey, I've only got 6-9 months of runway left, getting access to cash right now can be hard.
The guys at Fast spectacularly run out of runway.
Look, that has been picked over so many times. The fact that the ability to turn that size of money into nothing that quickly is astonishing. It's a wonderful lesson for any founder. I almost feel bad for them. But they've
got to have seen some lead indicators of the burn rate.
Look, if you know all the data, it can look like you're doing great because you spend a dollar and you get another customer, and you spend a dollar and you get another customer. But if then you find out because of a combination of churn plus cost of customer acquisition, the basic math here, and I recognize especially early on the data isn't clear, your lifetime value of your customer has to be greater than the cost of customer acquisition.
That's just such a revelationary statement that you just made there.
Otherwise, what you're doing is you're spending a dollar and you're turning it into 75 cents. And by the way, when the lifetime value is lower than the cost of customer acquisition, the faster you acquire customers, the faster you burn through your money. And if you don't have good data, you just don't know.
The All In podcast, the team did a fantastic job of breaking down some of these metrics. You know, the way that David Sacks and Chamath and some of those guys who are ridiculously experienced in this space, how they look at those ARR metrics, some of the key performance indicators. I just can't believe that somebody like Fast was allowed to just go out of business that fast. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's...
You know, it just... I mean, I know we've built a founders culture where VCs give founders money and then just let them get on with it. But there's got to be some more oversight. And I think we're going to see that as it gets harder to raise money, as multiples are compressed. Maybe we see back a bit more oversight on people being less trusting with their money from a VC.
We have the gentleman, there we go. Matt Turk was the VC that I couldn't remember. And he's coming back to mind again because... he posted a series of memes and comments that were quite funny. And I apologize, he's not at Union. He's at Firstmark. I'm all over the place this morning. He's at Firstmark Capital, Matt Turk, and he's done wonderful, wonderful things for the New York tech ecosystem. He posted a series of memes that, for instance, in the recent kind of fear of missing out, the FOMO funding environment, the first due diligence happens at, quote, the first board meeting, meaning after you've already written the check.
What have I invested in and what do these guys do again?
Exactly. And there's probably, I think it's stuck because there's a little more truth to that than I think a lot of VCs maybe wanted. When you think about the track record that a Firstmark has built, where Thomas Tungas is at Redpoint, the track record they built, if we start talking about some of the other big boys, Andreessen Horowitz and Sequoia and whatnot, part of that comes from real discipline when the markets are getting frothy, still only engaging with good companies who you know are going to be there for the long haul. It's much easier. I mean, everyone in a rising market, everyone looks like a hero. As the market's shaking out, you find out who's swimming naked.
And I think that's a great way to wrap up the after show. What a great
swimming analogy. Naked. That's,
I like that.
You've heard it here first. Swimming naked from Fat Tail Box.
Guys, you've been listening to the after show where Jared and I just get to
swim naked.
Swim Sorry. Naked in the Fat Tail Thoughts universe. We may or may not do this every week, but we often have a chat after the podcast where we oftentimes go into a lot more detail or goof around and enjoy the topic. We're going to try...
Revealing amount of detail, you might call it.
Yeah, yeah. We freestyle it. So you've been listening to the after show of the Fat Tail Thought podcast. We'll hopefully see you next week. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next time.